Hey, people, you might have heard me talk about a documentary I did the narration for a little while ago. It's called Sidemen, Long Road to Glory, about the incredible lives and legacies of three legendary bluesmen, Pine Top Perkins, Willie Big Eye Smith, and Hubert Sumlin. Starting today, you can pre-order it exclusively on iTunes. It features Bonnie Raitt, the late Greg Allman, Derek Trucks, Susan Tedeschi, Tim Reynolds, Joe Perry, and more. It's a great look at popular music history, so get it on iTunes starting today. That's Sidemen, Long Road to Glory. All right, let's do the show.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to it. Today on the show, I talk to actor David Harbour from Stranger Things. Maybe you've seen him in other movies. Black Mass. The Equalizer with Denzel. He was in that. He was in Brokeback Mountain. But I guess most people know him now because of Stranger Things. Whenever I see David Harbour on screen in one form or another, Revolutionary Road he was in. But whether it's on TV or movies, I'm like, there's something about that guy. What's up with that guy? He's memorable to me. And then we met at one of the award shows. And then we kind of got to talking in a crazy way, like two crazy people. And then we made this happen. I recorded it a little bit ago back in the old garage, part of the transition. But it was one of these, WTF interviews that there was definitely some emotional connective tissue between Mr. Harbour and myself. I feel like I knew the guy. I feel like I've known him for centuries. One of those kind of things. Like, yes, we've both been here before, you know? So that was enjoyable. Enjoy that. That's coming your way. You know, folks, I really do not understand the stupidity of humanity at times. This isn't even in a political sense. This is, look, if it's pouring rain and it doesn't look like it's going to let up, I think you can be optimistic that it'll let up, hopefully, before the flooding starts. And it's reasonable to think from experience that rain will let up or that it won't get as bad as it could get. But, you know, lava, there's no precedent for lava. There's just people hanging out, not letting it ruin their vacations in Hawaii. Lava, it's hot, molten rock from the center of the earth. And people are just sort of like, I think it's okay. How's the lava today? It's all right. They're not predicting it's going to get too bad. How the fuck does anybody know what lava is going to do? People are just playing golf. They're riding bikes. They're not leaving their land. The lava, it seems slow moving, but I don't know, man. I'm sorry if anyone who's listening to this is going through it, but like, get some distance, man. It's the island you're standing on was made out of lava. I don't know how long it took, but it probably slowly, but who the fuck knows how much is going to blow out of that hole? People just, playing volleyball, having a time. Newscasters, lava bubbling out of a hole in the earth from the core of the fucking earth. Maybe it doesn't go down that deep. I don't know. Hot fucking lava just bubbling and spraying out of holes. And people are just sort of, it's right over there. We don't know how bad it's going to get. What if it gets really bad? It'll just, the monument to the great volcano in Hawaii of 2018. And when they start excavating in 100, 200 years, not unlike Pompeii, the new excavated bodies, stone bodies taken from this particular natural disaster will just be in mid-golf swing, or perhaps they'll catch a kid on a skateboard as he tries to jump a fissure. I don't know, but it's sort of baffling, and I don't know that I wouldn't do the same thing. God knows there's been fires close by, and you just hope it doesn't get too close, but you can track that. Seems a little unpredictable when the earth is going to gurgle and cough its core out at out into the open and make a new part of the island. I don't know. I'm not there, so I can't. I don't know for sure what's happening. I started watching the new season of Glow, which I am involved with. I am an actor on it. And I've put it off long enough. I've had access to the new season for months. I'm not sure why I put it off, but I don't know. There's just something. It's something I don't watch myself that often unless I have to. I don't listen to myself that often unless I have to. But I wanted to see how everyone else was doing. I wanted to see how the show looked. I wanted to see how it all came together. So I've watched, I think, 7 or 8 episodes, and it's pretty fucking good. Everybody's good. And I don't know. It is still difficult to watch myself on the show, but I'm happy with my work. There's definitely room for improvement. Anyway, the new season of Glow is excellent, and you're all going to get to see it on the 29th of this month. Okay? All right. We'll see if tyranny is the way of the future. We'll see if American authoritarianism occurs. We'll see how the Mueller team reacts to this new letter from Trump's lawyer saying, hey, man, the prez can do whatever the fuck he wants. Ain't no rules, just some assumptions. No rules, just assumptions. Constitution's not specifically clear about the gray area in this, but looks to us, if you chip it away, that the prez can do whatever the fuck he wants, so you're just lucky he's letting you do what you're doing, all right? So shut the fuck up, back off, everybody. No rules. No rules. Just assumptions and tradition. Write them down, man. Somebody better write them the fuck down. What else has been happening? What's going on with you? Anything? I've been doing a little comedy again. I'm enjoying my house. I'm starting to enjoy life. I'm not good at it. In these horrible times, in these dark times, the ironic thing is I'm starting to enjoy my life a little bit. My house. I've been buying some things for the house, and I walk around this house all the time. Even the garage. I love it. I love the sound in here now. This kid, Julian's, he built up these things, these panels, and I'm kind of closing in on some stuff. I'm going to get new windows, but there's something about the focus of this room that I'm really getting off on. And I don't know who you are or what your life looks like. Maybe it's difficult. Maybe it's okay, but things are okay right now for me. So I walk around my new house just thinking, like, is this going to happen? Am I really going to pull this off? Am I really going to get to live a nice life? Do I deserve it? Do I get this? Doesn't seem like I get it or I should get it. I don't know why. It's just like there's just this dumb wall of whatever the fuck it is in my goddamn brain that's like, this isn't yours. So that's my fight. So David Harbour is a great actor, an engaging guy. And I thought he was a little intense when I met him, and now I'm sure of it. You can see seasons 1 and 2 of Stranger Things, both on Netflix. He's also in the new Hellboy. He is the new Hellboy. That comes out next year. And we talk about that and other things. And also, at the time I recorded this, I was like halfway through Stranger Things season 2. I was almost done, but I'm done. I finished it. I loved it. And it was great to talk to David. This is him and I doing that. So here's the deal. When I first met you, right, at the SAG Awards, I don't know, it was giddy. You know, I think we were out front, yeah. and I said I made a joke, and I didn't even know why I felt like I could. You were all excited and manic, and I said, so I think I said to you, I was hoping you would finish, you know, whatever you started at the Critics' Choice.
You said that my Critics' Choice thing was described half the season of Stranger Things. It was surely a description of Stranger Things, right?
Right.
And so you wanted to know what happened, yeah. Kind of at the end of the second season.
Yeah, right, but you were very earnest about the whole thing. And your first reaction to me busting your...
I love the, the color on the word earnest. I appreciate it.
No, you were. You were excited about what you had written, and I was just making a joke, And your response to me was, fuck you. Fuck you.
I don't know why I felt that I could say that to you. But no. Yeah, I did.
But then you're like, people said we should talk. And I said,
yeah, I think
you were smoking a cigar.
I was just sucking on it. Yeah, oh. I just chew on them.
But then I said, all right, well, I'll have the bookers get in charge.
The bookers.
And you went, the bookers.
The bookers.
Oh, the bookers. Yeah, okay, the bookers. And I'm like, fine, fuck it. Yeah. Give me your phone number.
It just felt like, you know, have my people call your, it felt like the biggest slight, the biggest Hollywood slight. I mean, I live in New York, you know, we talk to people, you come out here and
yeah.
People want the bookers to help you out, the bookers.
And then I said, give me your phone number. You gave me your phone number. Then I texted you once bookers, and you said, I don't think I should have given you my phone number. And then I said, no, we're going to handle it. And you're like, okay, good. And then I texted you again, and you don't get him anymore. And I said, did I cause him to change his phone number?
Yeah, it's funny. Did you text me again?
Yeah.
You did. Wow. Yeah, no, I have a different number. My, I had an Instagram thing happen where my phone number got released on Instagram.
Oh, really?
And I didn't know it. And I looked at my phone and I suddenly got like 100 missed calls from like Topeka, Kansas.
But was it just
and
it fans? Was
and I checked a couple of the messages and they were like, hello. like hundreds of messages of that, and I was like, what do you do in these situations? I guess you change your number.
I
mean, I've never changed my number, though. That's a kind of horrific experience, because you're sort of known, and then you have a list of contacts, mainly people that I don't speak to,
right?
But occasionally you get people who, like, you don't really know who texting you,
sure,
and they're like, they don't have your number anymore,
right?
But I feel presumptuous to actually send my new number out to someone like you, like, it feels a little bit like aggressive to be like, hey, you know, if you need to contact me.
No, it's better that I just think you're a big shot.
Exactly.
Like my two
changes
texts.
His number.
You're like, that's it. I think I texted you a picture of a cigar I was smoking, and then I texted you the other day just because I knew you were coming on, and they, you know, they show up green instead of blue. Like they're just texting into nowhere.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like,
I've never met someone who changed their number. Thank you for that.
Well, no, I mean, that number, probably they'll redistribute it eventually.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, I actually have some guy's number now. I shouldn't have changed my number because I have Earl's number.
Earl.
And Earl gets calls from all kinds of people. I get normal personal calls where I'm like, Earl doesn't live here anymore. And then he gets a lot of, like, he's got some credit ish or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like they're always offering him deals.
Well, you know, that goes with the name Earl. You know, you can't. Yeah. You know, you don't meet a lot of Earls that are in good shape.
It's true. Earl is like one of those names where you have to be around 60 or 70.
Yeah,
the kids aren't being called. The children aren't being called Earl anymore.
I don't know
why
not. I think it's maybe.
Yeah, I feel like it's a throwback to like medieval time. The Earl of
Maybe.
It's the.
I thought it was more of a kind of a, you know, a small townie. Name like Earl. That's Earl
the
barber.
Farm. Like there he is.
I think
Earl
so.
Out on his tractor.
But it is not one of those ones that was resurrected by the hipsters, like with the Jacobs and the Phoenixes and the mountains and the whatever they are, Parkers and I don't know what are those
truth,
fucking names.
Truths. Yeah.
Is there some truths?
Yeah. Starlight Truth.
Oh, that's
Ernest.
Going. That's not even names. They're like, you know, we're done. We're tapped out on names.
Guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just they're just
nouns.
Naming things.
Yeah. Dog. But so that makes me happy because it wasn't adding up that you would still be coming over if I had caused you to change your number. So we got that resolved.
I'm glad that you took that on, though. I appreciate you.
Oh, no, I'll take anything.
Yeah, I love it. I love that neurosis. Me too.
Self-hatred. Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
Is it?
Well, I find people with a lot of, I actually do find people with a lot of self-hatred or an unhealthy amount of self-hatred, like, for sort of beautiful people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we do have a certain, like, you'd rather take it out on yourself than on someone else, right?
Well, yeah. It's sort of like, you know, if someone says, I'm going to kick your ass, you're like, nah, I'm on it. Don't. No need.
Exactly.
I got it covered.
Yeah.
You just look at a
and
person.
Like, even when you're angry at someone else, you know that person is just sad inside.
Yeah, sure.
And they're the angriest at themselves.
Sure.
And that sort of makes you feel like, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
But maybe that's kind of an excuse that I have when I get for getting angry at people is that they know that.
That
it
you're
might
sad.
Be some sort of justification. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Like if you work
for bad behavior.
Right. Yeah. Have you worked that into your apologies? with the crying lady? Hey, look, I'm so sad. I'm sorry that I said those things.
Not in that direct a language, but yes, some form of that. Yes, I'm sure I have. Be it in a look or an eyebrow raise or something like
that. Sure. Yeah. No, it's hard to have. Well, I think I'm older than you, and believe me, the unresolved...
I think you're older than me, too.
I am. The unresolved self-hatred eventually becomes exhausting, and you realize, like, do I really need to have this be part of my process anymore? Because for some reason, most of your life, you think it's not a choice, and it kind of isn't, but you can temper it, you know what I mean, eventually?
It becomes
exhausting to other people. It's a self-involved.
That's true.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a funny thing, even in terms of like stress in general. And just, I've always had a feeling like as an artist that you have to be sort of more in touch with all kinds of things.
Right.
Like even the idea of your personal truth.
Yeah.
Which can be very annoying to people, do you know what I mean? And at a certain point, you're kind of like, whether or not I have to say my truth at this point, or whether or not I have to be even true to that,
right?
Like, maybe I can just be happy, and maybe I can just like shut my mouth and just kind of chill out and feel a little uncomfortable, but like in the long run, that'll be a better way to live in a certain way.
Yeah, but it depends where all that other stuff's being stored.
Yeah, because it can be sublimated and then come out in really creepy ways. Like,
I'm happy, and then one day you just lose it.
On the coffee maker.
Yeah. That's it. That's broken. Now I got to clean this up. And that could go for, that's a metaphor for anything.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I broke it. And I don't know if I can. I like the idea of you
just stomping around your house after 5 years of sublimating stuff, just breaking, just
breaking
going,
everything.
I broke it.
Yeah, it's everything's
broken. It.
Yeah. And then someone comes over and you're just sitting there smiling. I feel better. I feel better now. Doesn't look good. But I wonder ultimately that, you know, clearly we have something in common, which is our expectations that we set for ourselves are unreachable. And, you know, which, you know, becomes, you know, like that's what self-hatred is. Like, what is self-hatred really?
I'm not good enough.
Who are you comparing yourself to? Everyone. Do you have a personal goal in mind? No. You know, so
it's just a constant comparison coming up short.
Yeah.
Constantly coming up short.
Right. Yeah. Like, it's a hard place to keep yourself, you know,
but it's I've done pretty well.
It's natural. And I think that it is, you know, it has informed your roles.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for noticing. Yes. No, the work that you are drawn to is also drawn to you.
Oh,
right?
Dude, that moment in Black Mass where you're like, we're fucked.
Yeah. That's how I wake up in the morning. That's exactly how I wake
up. What's that other actor's name? Egerton?
Egerton. Yeah,
Egerton.
Yeah.
He's good, but he's sitting there like, nah, we're good. It's going to work. And you're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's close to home. Oh, but like with Stranger Things, which it was funny because it was one of those things where I'm like, I don't know, there's fantasy stuff. So, but
wait,
but
was
like,
it the fantasy stuff or was it the hype stuff? Because I wouldn't have watched it as a result of the hype stuff.
I don't pay that much attention to hype. Eventually I get to things, but like I just thought like it was for kids. What do I know? But like then again, like I watched The Shape of Water, and I didn't think I was going to watch that, but I was going to watch the Oscar movies. And as you know, even it was fantasy, and the guy was a fish guy. You know, I was going to be pretty upset if he didn't live. You know, like I was going to turn it off.
Like,
if this goes that way,
if
the fish guy dies, I'm not going to be able to really deal with life for like two or three days.
That movie really affected you.
Everything affects me. You have aquatic empathy.
Well,
I'm finding as I get older and as the world ends that you know, I'm very, you know, raw and sort of open. So
yeah,
but I'm also like,
as you get older, do you think that's sentimentality or do you think that's like you just get wistfully sentimental about all sorts of things?
I think what's happening is, you know, because I've had an incredible lack of ability to function, you know, in my real life comfortably with intimacy, that all the emotions are coming out in weird places. That, you know,
when you're watching fish movies.
By myself.
Yeah, exactly. On the couch. I do a lot of that too.
Sobbing, eating
3 in the morning, weeping.
Yeah.
Slowly, quietly weeping.
Yeah. Just kind of.
It's a beautiful image. I'm going to take that with me.
You know, and then you stop yourself and you're like, why am I
stopping? She has gills. They are meant to be.
They're
going to
be all right. And then the sad part about crying by yourself is when you stop yourself. You sort of like, that's it. That's it. Like, who are you doing that for?
That's it. I'm glad you vocalize it too, talking to yourself about it.
But so like with Stranger Things though, You know, I have a propensity from back in the day when I was, I think, a little more borderline personality disorder and a little more hopped up on cocaine. Where there you go. I had a, you know, I was pretty conspiracy minded, you know, a couple decades ago. So anything that triggers my shadow government, you know, node, yeah, because, like, I swear to God, for about the first six episodes, I'm like, this kind of makes sense. Like, this is not so far fetched. Sure, we don't know what the hole is or why the fuck they opened it,
but they did.
The jump from MK Ultra acid to that hole, you know, I wish it's not that
big of a leap.
Right. I wish they'd go into it a little more, but.
So you thought it was a documentary?
Yeah, a little bit. At the beginning, I'm like, you know, I think they I know the kids are cute, but you know, where's the explanation for the hole? It doesn't matter, really, because I know the kid, you know, has these gifts, and, you know, there's other universes, and it was from the hallucinogenics and the experiments where, you know, they were able to tap into these other universes through what aren't hallucinations. Somehow they've manifested the whole to the parallel universe.
Correct.
That anyone who's done acid or mushrooms knows.
right.
Even if you weren't part
Maya
of
Maya or whatever you. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's always like when you're tripping, you're sort of like, did I just see an elf? You know, like there's a moment, there's something on the periphery where you're like,
it's all illusion anyway.
There's that. Right. But then there's actually like, what's that fucking guy's name? I always forget. Guy wrote a book. He was sort of positioning himself to be the modern sort of Timothy Leary hallucinogenic. He was at the cutting edge of the new interest in what's that new, the hallucinogen that people are doing now, like, you know, like little hipsters are going down to.
Ayahuasca.
Yeah. He was it was like at the beginning of that. And the point is, in his book, states that through his hallucinatory experiences, he believes there's a parallel universe that's sort of got beings in it. So that's my only point. Okay. And now what's happened in Stranger Things is somehow or another, you know, they opened the door to it.
Hopefully, to me, this will be something that we explore further. I mean, they have to sort of explain like what it is eventually. Like, is it the future? Is it a parallel universe?
Daniel Pinchbeck.
No idea.
It's all right.
Daniel Pinchbeck wrote Elves on the Edges?
No. No.
It's all a clown show.
That's what I took from it.
Elves on the Edges. It really does sound like the title of my autobiography. I mean, I'm like really excited about that title.
No, he wrote Elves on the Edges. It should be called that. Hold on. No, the book that I read. Oh, come on. Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism.
Okay.
2012, Return of Quetzalcoatl.
I like shamanism. That's cool.
Do you?
I went through a huge phase. Who's that guy? Euclid or something? Like, wrote a book called about shamanism that I tried to read like 800 pages of and then got pretty bored.
Tell me the truth. As a self-hating, self-centered
guy. How about this? You ever read Julian Jaynes?
No.
The breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Oh, I've seen that book.
Origin of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Okay,
the bicameral mind is basically this idea, which I find kind of interesting, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is like in Greek times, like, you know, you had Athena, like going and inspiring Telemachus in the Odyssey or something.
Sure.
So, like, the idea of God.
Guy can't just do something because he feels like it.
Well, yeah, but he actually doesn't have consciousness.
Uh-huh.
Like, they're saying that it doesn't, like Telemachus, that time, people didn't have consciousness.
Right.
The consciousness was broken down by this idea of gods and people.
Right.
So, like, even the idea of genius, like, living in the walls, like, all these ideas were that actually the people back then weren't conscious, and that consciousness sort of incorporates these two sides of the brain. Like, gods and, like.
Oh, that, well, that's good.
It's kind of interesting, yeah. I don't know.
So, like, how many pages in? Did you stop?
So I think it was page 54. By the way, shut up. Like, in terms of stopping on pages, I would like to say that the bookshelf
I've covered
over
this.
Here is. Oh, have you talked about the bookshelf?
Sure.
Before?
Like, I
have to say, like Gravity's Rainbow stuck out at me as like
12 pages.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, I was like Gravity's Rainbow, but you gotta have it. No, it looks so smart.
No,
right?
No, I leave it up there because I'm gonna try it. I'm gonna try it again. Yeah,
eventually, you're gonna try it. Like you're gonna be like 90.
But no, but like I've talked about like underlining, you know, a lot. But like it all stops at page 13 to 45.
Also, can I talk to you about the underlining book thing? Because like you sit there with a pen and underline a book, right?
I do. Yeah.
Do you ever go back and look at what you've underlined?
Sure.
You do.
Well, no, and okay, I'm always really. Do. Like, that's what, like, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, it's so stupid, right? You read the paragraph and you're like, I underlined that line? Right.
Yeah, no.
Why that line?
Like, that book, I don't think I underlined in that book.
What's this, Brothers Karamazov or Happiness for Dummies?
There's some underlines. Oh, good.
Oh, here we go. It's a dramatic reading.
No, this was a book.
We're going to eventually get into mustache grooming, aren't we? That's really what I came here for.
It's about the same, isn't it? This book, I love this book. It's called Securing the City, the Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. It's a book about how the NYPD became its own security entity after 9/11 because they didn't really have, you know, this financial support from the FBI, U.S. government, or the CIA, who was battling with the FBI. So New York had it sort of take it on itself to put together the best security force in the world through the NYPD. It's a great book. Well, the thing is like when I was going through it, I saw like there was one underline. And now, like, that's always the good ones where it's just like it looked like I underlined one bit of dialogue in here, and I think I remember what it is. Oh yeah, this, I love this because I've sort of paraphrased this before. He's talking to a cop. The sergeant liked to use cop speak to simplify big issues. He told me an old homicide detective once told him, as they stood looking at a body in the street, that the motives for all murders, quote, come down to three things: pussy, fear, and money, unquote.
Oh my God.
And he paused, and I've thought about that since, you know. Then the older I get, the more I think, yeah, that's about right, unquote.
No, that's like right out of a film noir.
Right, yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Well, why wouldn't
that's
I
supposed to be
that?
Real? Yeah, that's a brilliant underline.
Yeah.
Mine are much stupider than that. Congratulations. Like
big concepts? No, we could find some stupid ones.
No, that's good, though. Yeah, that's a good one.
I guess the point of this, like what I was getting to when you bring up, because what I hear when you say, you know, you've gone on some of these spiritual journeys or you're open to this or that, shamanism or whatever,
is
not unlike me. You know, like I'm fascinated with it, but I'm not hanging any hope on it. you know what I mean? Like I'll look into it. But I don't see myself as a guy on a spiritual quest. I know what that looks like.
I don't
like.
See you as that guy either.
My brother's kind of that guy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always work out. But,
No. I mean, I'm 42 now, right? So, like, I've had 20 years of, doing this stuff. And I do. Well, like, getting fascinated by religious journeys. I mean, for a while, like, when I was... it's funny that you sort of lucked into this. I don't know if you have some weird kind of like shaman intuition, but it had been a big part of my life until recently where I actually gave it up entirely. And
you lost your faith.
I lost my idea that for me, I was always looking for the answer.
Well, when did this start?
Like now I don't care about the answer and I don't even want to ask the question, and I'm like totally fine with dying.
It's enough, you know, you're dying.
Yeah, like, and I'm cool with that. Like, I don't need an afterlife. I don't even need a reincarnation. Like,
it sounds exhausting.
Cool
to fucking afterlife. Wait, this has to keep going. I mean, what if forever?
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing. I mean, like, it does. Like, I'm good with consciousness being like 60 or 70 years, and then we're like good. Like, I've kind of done what.
Even if our consciousness goes back into the big pool, we're not going to know about it.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not going to be like, oh, spread out. You know, like.
Well, that's the funny thing about, because here's the thing. Like, I have a friend who, this is funny, a college fraternity brother.
Yeah.
We went to Dartmouth together. And then, everybody at Dartmouth was. I know.
Don't worry about it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. But anyway, he became a Buddhist monk with a guy called Thich Nhat Hanh.
The anger guy.
Sure, he's a lot of things. I mean, like, but sure, the anger
guy. Didn't he write a book about anger?
Yeah, he wrote a book. He's written like 80 books, though.
That was the one that was gifted to me.
The one you were drawn to, like a bug life.
It was given to me.
Okay.
Here, I hope this. Maybe this will.
But anyway, there's a monastery down in Escondido that he's at. I would go visit him down there. And I'd go like hang with the monks. And I got really into Buddhism for a while.
Yeah.
And it is funny, but this idea even about reincarnation is that you don't get to take, the one thing you don't get to take with you is your ego. So any of your own like knowledge of yourself,
self-awareness,
like, don't get to take.
What a ripoff.
Or like how great, like as to our point, like after 60 or 70, you know, I'm going to be done with my own ego.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'm ready to put that to bed. Like it's done its job.
I don't know how your dad's doing, but it hangs on. Like the late '70s is not giving up that easy.
Yeah,
ego. Hanging pretty tight.
But I did go on. Like it was funny. Even when I was 20, I think when I was 25, I got into Catholicism, and I almost
what were you born as?
Converted to Catholicism. I was born as like a Christmas Eve Protestant, which is like you just go and light the candles on Christmas Eve and sing songs.
So where'd you grow up?
In Westchester County, which town? White Plains.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So nice New York.
Yeah.
It's nice. It snows. There's seasons. Yeah, there's trees.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then you can just drive to the city, maybe.
Well, yeah, or take Metro North train, the ice storm train, or whatever. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Don't get electrocuted.
Exactly.
So, all right. So your parents, what would they do?
The real estate. My dad was real estate, commercial real estate in White Plains.
Oh, in White Plains.
Yeah.
Small timer.
But
he had a good business.
Office
parks, a shopping mall.
Yeah, exactly. I remember, actually one of the fondest memories I have of my dad was like driving around, I think when I was like 8 or 9, and I remember him, like he never talked about business with me.
Yeah.
Like he would never, at dinner, it would always be about me.
Yeah.
He would never talk about anything. And then we drove around White Plains and at one point he had a sign on like a big building. It was like a big old Sears or something.
Right.
And it was like the sign of like, and he was like, I'm leasing out that building. And I was like, it was like the most exciting thing. And it was the first time that my dad ever like was proud of business in front of me. And I was like, this is cool, Dad. I was like, that's amazing.
Yeah,
it said like, it said like his company, like HCR. And it was like his small business, because it was his business that he ran, him and like, I think he hired another guy at one point.
Yeah.
But it was a very small White Plains real estate business.
And what about your mom?
And my mom was a homemaker until we left for college. She was a housewife.
What'd she end up doing?
She wound up doing residential.
Got her license.
Residential. Got her license.
That's a common theme.
And business cards and park benches. Yeah, yeah.
My mom sends me her real estate calendar with her picture on it every year. Her little,
really?
Yeah. Tell me, Marin, agent.
Wow.
It's a calendar.
She's still in it.
Yeah, but she doesn't have the disposition for it. She's not a killer. You know, she's down in Florida. Like in her development, if she knows the person, you know, it seems they let her sell the house for them, you know, but she's never been, a snake.
Yeah, my mom too. I mean, my mom was always a creative. Like I got all of my creativity from my mom.
Yeah.
She just never sort of had the opportunity or to sort of be creative. And
So how do you know? My mom paints and she started painting again.
Really?
Yeah. She painted when I was a kid, and she kind of gave up on it. Like she got crushed. I think she went to get her master's when I was like, in my 20s, and I think it was just too much for her to be the older lady in the
My mom would do these things. She would do like crochet and needlepoint and stuff when she was a kid, and then she also made these things, which I would love to find them. But she would make like. Like, because they all grew up in Texas and Houston.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, like, real Southern, weird, like, Irish.
Yeah.
Irish by way of Houston, by way of, like, stainless steel for oil.
Uh-huh.
So, like, big sort of matriarch oil company.
From her side of the family?
From her side of the family. And very much like, you ever watch Dallas?
Yeah.
You know, like, a little bit like Dallas.
Sure.
Like, not as much money, but,
Texas is Texas. I can see how you could fit into that.
Yeah. Sure. I would go down there. They were my favorite family because they were... they were Irish, they were charming.
Tall and you can handle a hat.
Yeah, and I had a little hat when I was a little cowboy from 5 years old. I used to have that little cowboy hat
sure.
with the
The straw
armadillo
Stetson?
Pin. On oh, yeah. The, yeah, it was like a tie pin that I found that was an armadillo. Yeah. Put it right in the front.
Had your boots.
I remember I remember we used to play poker in the back room of the corporation. It was called the Riley Corporation. It was like one because they didn't do any business basically. So me and
this
the guys.
This is the oil
play.
Business?
Yeah. It was a stainless steel for oil. Yeah. Pipe, but like they weren't doing any business. I mean,
these
it was
are
all
cousins,
done.
Second cousins.
Well, so these were like dudes who worked in the office who I loved because I would just go sit with them. Right. They were fascinating, like older guys. I was like six and like these guys would just make jokes and we would buy like they got me into like blowguns. Do you know what blowguns are?
Like darts?
Yeah, like darts. Sure. They'd buy me things like that, like bows. And And then at one point we played like poker. You know, I was so excited.
These guys seem like really good with kids.
So here's the thing. So one of them won. He said I didn't have enough money or enough chips. And he was like, well, let's bet your hat. And I was like, okay. And I lost.
And did they stick
and
with
all
it?
Day long he wore this like teeny cowboy hat around and taunted me. And I was like miserable. I mean, crying. I couldn't believe it. I lost my hat.
You're crying?
Yeah, like the whole day. And him just sitting at his desk. Yeah, him just, of course, man. This was a different time. First of all, a time that I kind of miss.
Yeah.
Like, these guys were hard guys, you know? Yeah. I mean, and even in terms of the show, like Stranger Things, like that guy is modeled on all these guys.
Yeah.
Like, guys who were like, you don't cry as a guy, like you know what I mean. But like I was so miserable. And he just wore it around all day, like walked around the office all day. This teeny tiny cowboy hat.
When did he give?
And
it
then
back?
He gave it back to me at the end of the day.
So hours.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Like a full day, like a full business day.
Hey, what did you learn from that, David?
I mean, I just
what
learned.
Did that man teach you?
I don't know. Was nothing. There was no lesson. It was just funny.
Was it?
I mean, looking back, I recall it with fondness. At the time, it was painful. Sure,
but it was an adult hurting you.
Yeah,
on
actively.
Purpose.
For no reason.
But,
I mean, I guess don't play poker.
There you go.
Yeah,
it's sort of like you got to pay your debt.
Exactly. If you make choices, there are consequences.
That's what you learned that day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, hold on
time.
To your hat.
But my mom did used to make with her sister, she made these like trash cans and they would cut out like from magazines, from like old magazines, like even National Geographic or Time or Life or whatever, and like all these scenes.
Yeah.
And they would make these scenes with like some kind of thick, resiny, yellowy, rubber cementy type thing and cover the whole thing.
Yeah.
And they were beautiful, but
they're gone?
Yeah, they're gone. I don't know where they are.
Are your parents around?
They are. They're in Westchester. Yeah.
You can ask her.
I could, yeah. I mean, the thing is, we sort of fell out with that family in Texas, so we we kind of don't talk to them much anymore.
Oh, well, I thought it was your mom's trash cans.
They were, but I think that like they were sort of in a closet in my grandma's place, right?
Oh, so you fell out with your grandma?
Well, it all sort of, after she died, it all sort of fell apart.
Money?
In a sordid, exactly. Is that what happens just to everybody?
Oh, no, just reading that book, the Money, Pussy, and Fear seems to be... That's why people die. I imagine it trickles down.
And it's why relationships die.
Yeah, sure.
It's because of, it was one of the three.
Yeah, that's the triangle.
I mean, I think there was some fear as well.
That's the trinity.
But it's a funny thing, though. It actually really soured me on, money with my family. Like, I don't want, but I don't want any sort of inheritance. Like, I want to give that all to my sister. Like, it freaks me out that people get like.
Yeah, I'm not hung up on that either. You know, but I guess I understand it if the stakes are big enough. But it always I realize as I read the paper and I see people's behavior, sort of in their shameless lack of a moral compass when it comes.
Isn't that
to
weird? Like, I don't understand the evil, like greed. Like, I really don't understand. Like,
I don't get
it
either.
Like, because me and you both, it sounds just, like you. Like, I live in a 450 square foot, alcove studio in the East Village.
Yeah,
and like I don't have if I have a family, I'll probably need another bedroom. Or something.
Yeah,
but like the idea that you need.
I didn't think
so
that
much
way.
Stuff.
Yeah, it's
like,
for a
why
long
do
time.
We need so much stuff?
I just bought a bigger house and I don't have enough stuff to fill it, and I feel a little weird about it. But I just felt like maybe it would be interesting to experience more space because it doesn't look like I'm going to have a family. But my point is here is that like for me, like outside of giving money to charity, maybe I could use a little to expand my quality of life. But I never grew up like and I've thought about this a lot recently, is that people who set out to make money figure out a way to make money in the same way that you talk about the
achievement
work.
Exactly.
And
it's a thing they want.
It's all they want.
Yeah.
I mean, that is,
but it's just numbers.
What are you going to do with your life? Yeah, I'm going to make money.
Exactly.
I got to figure out a way. What's my hustle? What's my racket? What angle am I going to work to make the money to have that life? But with the suing and all that stuff, it's sort of like, you know, like I can't deal with what it turns people into, you know, and it's not all the individual. I mean, I've gone through, you know, one divorce that was not so bad and another divorce that was fucking awful, you know, and it was just, it was about, you know,
about money.
It went in an entitlement and, you know, in retrospect, I understand it. You know,
well, it's also a way to hurt someone, right? Like in those negotiations, it's just a way to like.
Yeah, but a lot of times they're turned out by evil fucking lawyers.
Yeah. Everybody likes to hurt people. I mean, come on, let's, you know.
Yeah, look at that guy with your hat. It goes way back.
That was the lawyers, though, Mark. That was the lawyers.
And also, like as a kid, I gravitated towards charismatic older guys because my dad was relatively emotionally unattentive. And I liked, you know, the stories, and they seem to have defined sense of selves
in spiritual senses.
No, just in like when you talk about hanging around with the old guys.
Oh,
when you're younger, you're just sort of like they're just whole people, and they're look at that guy seems to have his shit. Like he's a whole thing.
Yeah.
Like I went through most of my life being like I'm ill defined, and I don't have any boundaries, and like I don't know, am I a person? What's happening? Do I have a personality? You know.
Yeah.
It was always reactive. You know, most of my personality is built on reacting badly, generally.
Yeah.
And eventually I got funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know if that's something you had to deal with. I mean,
that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I identify tremendously with that idea that this ill-defined thing. I mean, I remember even in high school, like, writing an essay about how I felt like an alien, like, watching human beings from afar. I was very much kind of a quiet person who would, like, kind of watch and study. And that even bled into my fascination with religion or spirituality. It was just this idea that like other people had an answer that I didn't have.
And I sort of
walked around with this like fleshy thing that felt porous and like was weird and awkward. I felt awkward in my skin.
Where's my instruction manual?
Yeah, exactly. And you guys are all walking around like doing things in the world. And
yeah,
I'm
like
just
you have
like,
the answers. I get that when I see a guy with a leaf blower sometimes. Yeah. I'm like, that guy's got to figure it out. He's probably, you know, he's got a solid gut in place.
I think that's good. Keeps you humble, you know?
Yeah. Simple life. But every time I have that fantasy of like, you know, I'm just going to go off the grid, unlike drugs and alcohol and stuff, which I haven't done in years. It's sort of like, I know, like, if I do that, then like, you know, by day three, I'm going to be like, oh, what'd I do? You know, I'm in that fucking cabin. You know? Getting the cell coverage.
But no, I did the same thing. I don't do that stuff anymore either for years and years and years.
What? Oh, really?
Off the shit for 15 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Although I did have a little dalliance when I was out here like 5 years ago. I had a dip into what they know. You guys have medicine out here. Medicinal marijuana.
You rationalize?
I tried some of that.
You're like, I'm not great.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, this is medicine?
It never was my thing. It's like, you guys are all doing this for about 3 months and then like severe depression. It really is. I mean, it was a good thing to go back.
You went all in?
I mean, I can't do otherwise. Well, like, I got a card it was funny because I was working.
You're the asshole who believed the doctor, right?
Oh,
he's right. You know what I mean?
I went to Dr. Feelgood on Venice Boulevard, who looked like the sickest person I've ever met.
Isn't he on the boardwalk?
It was on the Venice boardwalk. And you pay $200 or something. I remember I was working on a TV show where I was like a regular, but I would only work like once every 2 weeks.
Time to hang around California.
And all I would do is sit in my house in Venice and just like eat gummies and, you know, just, and it was, it was so sad.
This sounds like it was a short film I'd like to see.
David or Harper. You would avoid like the plague. Like either one, you'd either really rush out to see it or.
Yeah. No, I think it should be called Gummies. But like, Were you a program guy?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So did you have to start over?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. It's humiliating. I had like 13 years or something. You go, and also like it was. I gotta say, like,
I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but I can, because we, if you have, I don't know, it's not.
No,
funny,
it's humiliating. It's my, absolutely humiliating.
My biggest fear. It's like, I swear to God, 90%. No,
well, so you know what's funny is, God, I wish you were at the meeting when I came back, because I have to say, like, I said that Adam, so I was like 10 days or something, right?
Right.
And I, they were like, it was a pitch. It's a super intense pitch meeting.
Yeah.
Like where the, it's like a bunch of old
timers. You're 10 days back?
Yeah. 10 days back. And the old timer like, you know, what do you got to say? And you're like, hi, I'm Damon. And then I was like, listen, I'm just, you know, I'm just feeling really bad about myself. Like I had, you know, I had 13, had 10 days. And, like, I feel like just a jerk. And like, and then like, the next guy crosstalked me.
Oh, man.
And was like, that's your ego talking. You are a selfish, like, and I was like, oh my God, I just want to die. And like, you're selfish because you want to die. I was like, oh, thanks. Welcome back.
Yeah, yeah,
you're the most important person in the room.
Yeah, yeah, right. Thanks a lot for the support and the malignant tough love,
exactly.
Jealous bastard. That you
exactly.
Didn't
but I will say in defense of the program that there were many people that came up to me and was like, that's not the way we do it here.
Yeah, that's the great thing about it. And I support it 100%. Like, it's not so much, I mean, I obviously, you know, and I always say I don't represent an AA, but I don't know another way. This is the way I
There's
know.
There's no other.
So, like, I know that, you know, when people ask me about that, if I get emails and stuff, I'm like, yeah, go to the fucking meeting.
Just go
like,
to a meeting.
I mean, it'll work or it won't work, but it's a way, and it's a context, and it doesn't cost nothing, and you just go, and, you know, if it doesn't stick, you know, whatever. But that's all that's really, like, anywhere you can go to that thing.
Yeah.
Like anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in Texas where for some reason, if I'm on the road and I look up a meeting, I will go to the worst one.
Yeah.
I would all the time. I will be like, where am I? Yeah. Do people live in this neighborhood?
Went to English speaking meetings in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
In Mexico. Yeah. Like Paris.
Expats.
All over the world.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. But okay. So what do you end up? How do you end up moving towards acting?
Okay, so that was, so basically what happens is, like, when I was
Brothers, sisters?
I've always been a ham bone. Yeah, yeah, my younger sister, 7 years younger.
Uh-huh.
But she, you know, the first 7 years developmentally are like sort of the most important.
Yeah.
So I was an only child sort of for the first 7 years.
Yeah, and look what happened.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have a lot of the components of, like, a lot of the traits of an only child in a certain way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you know your sister's name?
It's just foggy, but I can think of, if I go through my phone.
Yeah, lucky her.
No, I love her very much. Good. I love her very much. We're close, but it was, you know, it was hard for a while.
Sure.
But it was funny, like, when I think that it came out of that feeling. So, like, at first it was kind of a ham bone quality, like you're entertaining your parent. You're entertaining for some messed up reason.
Trying to get love somehow.
Exactly. Yeah. Or trying to solve problems.
Yeah.
Golden child sort of situation.
Oh,
I can fix problems that aren't beyond my control. And
the horrible thing about being the special golden child thing, or the first, I was the first kid and the first grandkid, both sides.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Is that, like, they eventually, if you manage to, you know, sort of, you know, entertain them sufficiently, they'll always think you have your shit together over anybody else. And and inside you're like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
I'm not,
really show them that you don't, right?
Like, no, because you're putting on a show.
Know? Exactly. Right. How could they know?
Well,
they're your fucking parents
and you should have some intuition.
Yeah,
this kid's acting out.
But everybody wants to, you know, just steal your hat. And So basically what happened was when I got to be, like, in high school and stuff, I sort of was drawn to that feeling of feeling uncomfortable in my skin and being confused by human beings.
Right.
Like, just constantly confused.
Yeah.
Led me to a couple different outlets, one of which was drinking.
Right.
And then there was also this other outlet where I would see people behave in certain ways and I wouldn't believe them. Like, they would say certain things and I felt like they would mean something different.
Oh, yeah?
Like, yeah, I just started to see subtext where people were like, ha, we're friends. We're friends. I love you.
Yeah.
And you just feel like you hate that person.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, so
why
this,
would you like me?
Right. Or why are you saying something that's completely counter? Like, why are you lying? And then the question becomes, why are you lying? Why do you have to lie? Like, why? And so I guess my brain just started firing on all these levels of, like, human beings are, they're confusing and I hate them. And also they're like fascinating. Like they're the only thing I want to think about besides spiders. I do really love to watch a spider, but I was so fascinated by why they make the choices that they do, why they lock themselves into situations that they seem to not like. Why don't people live the way they want to, or, you know, what is it that they're doing? And so that led me to like acting.
Yeah.
And I was like,
you're already doing the work.
Well, but I was also like an embarrassing person to have around because I would, I mean, I would like kind of, people would try to be at a party and like talk or something, and I'd be like that guy who was too intense. Who'd be like, I think you're sad inside or something. People would be like, why are you such a creep? Like, what's wrong with you?
And so you're the guy that sucked the energy out of the room.
Exactly. Like, just completely deflated. Like, deflated.
Why is
everything.
He here? Like, you're 20 people in a room.
Oh, you're so truthful. Like, thanks for ruining everything.
Yeah.
And so I found that, like, I definitely had this stubborn pride in my ability to see people, like this stubborn bride, like I know something. And then I would view it at parties or at friends and they would be like, you're a horrible human being, stop it.
Yeah.
And then I would go on stage and like sort of reveal it and people would like applaud me. And
right.
So it was very attractive. I was like, oh, so this sort of truth or this ability that I think I have to see people, I can do it through art or I can do it through expression of acting. But I just, you know, and so that made me hungry to do more of that. And like to read plays and like to get into like, you know,
so
character.
Instead of like, right. So instead of like projecting or maybe seeing people for who they
are. Yeah. And
are,
maybe not like, but just,
but you
I could at least see a character for what I felt the character
and
was.
Inhabit it.
Exactly. And reveal what I wanted to reveal through my particular Vershinin or whatever. Like it was, I had ownership. I don't have ownership of human beings. Like I can't, but I thought I did.
They don't bend to your will.
I mean, I try my hardest, but I did have ownership of that character and I could do something. And so it was a way of having relationships with imaginary or, you know, fictitious people that allowed me to bowl them over and you know, use them for my own expression.
In a context, a safe space.
Exactly. And also where I knew the end of the story.
Sure.
That was the other thing, too, was like emotionally I have real problems with conflict and real problems with just like vulnerability, emotion in general. And so I like to know the ends of stories. Like I like to know how things turn out.
Yeah.
That, like, you can behave in a certain way. And even in a way that sculpts what I'm drawn to in story, because I do think that you have somewhat of a responsibility as a storyteller to like craft it for the world, to like reveal to the world, like, if you do this in your life, you'll end up here. Or if you do this in your life, you might end up here.
So how did you lose, ultimately, you know, over time, you lost that weird, needy intensity?
No. Can't you feel it? Can't you feel it across the table here?
Well, I feel something. But no, a lot of what this podcast was is like, I don't know you, but like I had an exchange with you that was 2 minutes, but I decided some things about you.
Okay, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
You know, but like I do that with everybody because I talk to people with public personalities here. And like, you know, I'm pretty sure I got a sense of somebody. And I'm always, it's always, a lot of my interviews are people basically arguing against my idea of who they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great, though.
Yeah.
That you get a chance to do that.
Well, yeah, but I don't project it. I'm like, no. I know who you are. I don't do that.
That's what I do.
That's not a good interview.
Why I don't have a podcast.
Yeah. Stop talking. I got it.
That's my go-to. No, I... That's it. No, but I mean, I guess I do have a brash, I do have kind of a brash confidence. That is that what you're, like, what were you saying in reference to losing that needy whatever?
Oh, no,
I
mean, like, you know, because when you're that guy where, like, I feel that my version of that guy or people, I got a friend, you know, who was always pretty intense, but he's sort of a dick about it. You know, like when we were younger, you know, he was quiet and difficult and, you know, he was intimidating, but he never let on. And, you know, he was just sort of like, he liked being that, occupying that space. But for me, I find that all of that stuff, they sort of like, no, you're sad inside, or, you know, like, why are you guys going through this charade? There's no point to this game, you know, like, is that it, there's a need to it. Like, you know, I need attention, or I'm sad, or okay. Yeah. So now we're all at my level, which is unhappy. And how do we fix
You're
this?
You're welcome.
Yeah. Like, you know, it had something to do with that lack of boundaries and not feeling whole. But like the gift of sucking the wind out of a room, you know, is, you know, this is no small, that's a large talent that you have to, no, I mean, you got to figure out how to wrangle it, you know, and then turn it in on itself. And yeah, it seems exactly. like you did.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But so you start pursuing it in high school, the acting?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I did as much as I could sort of in middle school. There was like little things, but it was mainly hammy. But then once I get into high school, I start to, be really confused about people. And I do like school plays. Like I just did high school plays and I auditioned for a community theater and like all that stuff. And I loved it so much.
Yeah.
You know, like I just, it was the only thing besides drinking.
Yeah.
And like girls that like made any sense to me.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I actually wanted to drop out of high school and sort of like move to New York City at like 17 and just like try it.
Do it, yeah.
But I was in a community that was very, you know, there was no examples of artists.
Like
it was all lawyers and doctors and, you know, business people and real estate brokers and stuff. So it was, I was very much like.
And your parents, they get scared when you.
Everybody get, you know. So
like, that's not a good idea. Yeah. Finish high school first.
Yeah, you're going to go to Dartmouth and you're going to,
How'd you get into Dartmouth? You must have been smart.
That was a legacy.
Oh, okay. We take them. Okay.
He gave a couple bucks. No, I guess I was smart in a certain way. I mean, I was very, you know,
where is that
able
school
to
again?
Do school. It's up in New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah.
It was hard, though, to go to that type of environment. Because I just, I mean, first of all, I think kids going out of high school, it's like, I don't know why people don't, why people go direct into college. Like, I didn't want to go to college.
Yeah.
Did you go to college?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I didn't want to go either.
Yeah.
And then,
Where'd you go?
I freaked out my senior year. Like, I was sort of mediocre grades for all the way through junior year. And then, like, something just lit up in me. I'm like, I had this idea, like, I'm just going to hang out, you know, do art here. Cause I was like, you know, I knew all the groovy people by the university and stuff. And then, like, I don't know, I just realized, like, I got to get the fuck out of here. And, like, I did, my senior year, I finally turned all my grades around, but I still couldn't really get into a good school. And
I
ended up going to a small college for a year, and then I ended up going to Boston University for five years undergrad.
Wow. Took your time.
Yeah, you know, but I did a lot of stuff. You know, I acted, I wrote for the paper, you know, I edited, you know, I wrote poetry, I fucking, you know, I did all the stuff and cobbled together some sort of major at the end in English and film studies.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, that's the thing about college. It was great. It was like I did read books that I never would read in
real life.
I
wish I could go now. Like, I don't.
Me
like,
too. That's the thing. And I feel like as. I wish that there was a cultural thing. Like, I don't feel like, and this will be a horrible thing for me to say, but like, after you graduate high school, like, don't go to college. Like, go to college when you're 25 or something.
But
like, you're sick of school, right?
Right, there's that. But also, like, I just knew that, like, again, I wasn't going to be a business guy. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to be intelligent and intellectual. I wanted, like, what I wanted to know about theater, art, plays, movies. You know, that was, my goal was to be able to, you know, have conversations about that because of somebody, you know, in my life that I was very impressed with, that guy in that picture on the top of the bulletin board, Gus Blaisdell, like he was this intellectual powerhouse, owned a bookstore. And, you know, like he was like, you know, I decided that's the model. That's where it's at. You know a little bit about everything, engage your creativity. It had nothing to do with money, had nothing to do, but like explore shit.
But
so
don't
for
you,
me,
I mean, as a kid, you have so much energy and so much sort of.
But
like,
I'm mad that I couldn't understand philosophy. I couldn't wrap my brain around shit. I'm no good at math. So those kind of courses didn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
I'm not great at contextualizing, you know, history. So a lot of the things that require discipline and putting things into context, not great. But, you know, like I could write and you know, act and, you know, talk shit about movies.
Yeah.
That was all good. Like I still like I don't know. I couldn't fucking handle writing
but
papers.
So you didn't really get anything out of college. I mean, couldn't you have got that by just going to New York and like hanging out with a bunch of cool people?
I guess so, but there's also the problem that eventually led to my, you know, bottoming out on drugs.
Okay,
you know, so
yeah.
Like I'm not sure without the context, you know, which cradled me in my drug use and at least gave me some
that's
you know,
true
that, you know that I
because you still had to get up for class
yeah
and
do
like,
that
still,
stuff.
Yeah.
And you still could, you know, act like a big shot and do some writing and do some
that's
art
true
do,
that's true. It offers you an opportunity to like be a part of the paper or like whatever
right.
do some exactly.
But you know my heroes were all the you know wrong ones. They were good.
Yeah, mine
they,
too. All the ones that wound up in the mental asylums and like
yeah,
wound
course,
up being alcoholics.
Yeah, these guys
those
are
also the, they're the greatest.
Sure,
right?
Yeah,
I mean,
like who we talking about?
Like, I mean, for me, it was like F. Scott Fitzgerald and like all those writers from the 20s, like even a guy like, do you know a guy called Hart Crane?
Yeah.
So like Hart Crane or Tennessee Williams and all these, you know, then like, even like Ezra Pound.
Oh yeah.
Like I remember like we'd read a lot of that stuff.
For
like,
sure,
I love it. Exactly. Read the cantos of Pound.
Yeah. Let's read the cantos.
Exactly.
Like, we'll all come together.
But yeah, all those writers sort of from the turn of the century, like all those millennials of like, the 1900s.
Sure.
They were all my
Byron,
idols.
Shelley, those
guys. Exactly. Sure. Yeah. Like big romantic poets, big bipolar people. Whitman, like all those guys.
So you go to Dartmouth and there's acting there or no?
Some, yeah.
I mean, that's not where you did the acting.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, it's not through the department, though. Like, me and my friends got together and we wrote plays. And, we would put on our own plays. I started writing and I started getting into, like, you know, avant-garde directors. Like, you know, at the time, like Steven Berkoff and, like, you know, physical theater, Tadeusz Kantor. And, like, you know, we read, like, a lot of Grotowski and things like that. So we were really into, like, kind of avant-garde theater. Richard Foreman and, like, these guys that we, Robert Wilson. So we came to New York together. Even people like, I remember loving like Mary Zimmerman. Like we all took a road trip and went to go see like Journey of the West, like which is based on like an ancient fable. Like,
so you started
Monkey King and stuff. And so it was sort of like mythic, but Foreman. It was like we had this whole aesthetic. And
but
so,
your interest was like right out of the gate, really kind of provocative, envelope pushing theater.
Yeah. I mean, it was very heady stuff.
Yeah.
I look back on it as being not the most effective or provocative stuff I could have done, but at the time I felt that it was.
Well, it was arty, and you were young.
Yeah, exactly. And you're young, and that's what you do, right?
And it's very hard to understand.
But like, I remember even saying, like, you know, I'd rather be Brecht than Brad Pitt. Like, you know.
Sure.
That sort of feeling of like, and I would write like manifestos.
That's
like,
why you go to college.
Yeah. For lines like that.
You can't just go to New York and do that.
You're right. You can't. But I think it's also like the chicken and the egg. It's like when you're at college and not in New York, you have to develop that line because you're at college.
Yeah,
you don't just go to college. It's like you're like stuck at Dartmouth and people like Ed Norton are doing movies and you're looking at them ragefully I'd rather be Brecht.
Let's do our show in the basement of the cafeteria.
Exactly.
Yeah, but also it's confounding and it is part of like, you know, having a certain ego and then you get out into the real world and eventually that gets pounded out of you. But but like, what are you talking about? You know, like as you say, you know, once you get the fortitude, you accept and integrate, you know, that shameful part of your development. And you can laugh at it.
Yes. Yes. And you can use it and all sorts of things.
Right, right.
But they are great stories.
So when you leave Dartmouth, do you go right to New York then?
Yeah. So I go to New York and with a group of friends. And so we had a nonprofit theater company for like 2 years.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that's...
What was that called?
It's so...
I got to know the name.
Oh, no.
Come on.
This is so... Talk about vulnerability. Yeah. No, this is the most embarrassing thing I could ever...
What's
it called? Isis Ensemble. Okay. So Isis...
I'm about to cry.
I know. I'm about to cry too for different reasons though. The fact that I admitted that Isis were like in Hamlet, there's a line where he says when the players are coming, he says, there is, sir, an eerie of children, little Isis, who like cry on the top of questions. He's talking about players in the city that people really like that are like little children.
Yeah.
And so like it was born out of that. I mean,
Isis
like
ensemble?
Young hawks in Greek or something. It's so embarrassing. I look back.
There might be someone listening going like, I used to love that place.
Okay. All right. I think maybe three people saw our plays, but we wrote, you know, we would like sort of co-write these like plays together, these like weird plays, and we'd like put them up. But it was basically like the thing about having a nonprofit theater company in New York that's so sad is like you come out of college and all you're doing is begging your parents' friends for money to support the theater.
Yeah, yeah.
And all their kids are like, you know, hedge fund guys or
And
you're just humiliated. I mean, just constantly humiliated.
Right. Yeah.
By like, what are you doing with your life?
Sure.
So you drink and, you know.
Yeah. And you talk about the theater.
And you sit around in the bars, like smoking gitans and a beret.
Yeah.
talking about the theater and like, when people don't understand. We must create a new theater.
Right. And when did start, when did the people start peeling off?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened. Pretty early on. Pretty early on. And then basically, like, I was with my girlfriend at the time. Like, we were sort of the co-heads.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that broke up. And that was like...
It's like, it just destroyed
real the lesson in
the
you
whole
know.
Community around
exactly.
The IOSIS.
it was so so that went by the way, but also it was in a combination with my bottoming out.
Oh
so,
yeah. Oh really? That's
oh,
when that happened.
Oh god, yeah. Oh god, yeah. So it was all wrapped up in first of all just this anger at the world.
Yeah.
And righteousness and self-centeredness of like, when am I going to get mine?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
When are they going to recognize my genius with my theater company? Like
doing nothing and having knowing idea how to get any sort of attention whatsoever. Just, you know.
No, just arriving.
Yeah.
Just like arriving in New York.
That
and
weird
like,
expectation.
Are, right?
I'm
that
here.
Exactly. Yeah. Did you have that as well when you like.
Well, yeah, I used to say, you know, it takes, you have to realize that Hollywood is not your parents. That, you know, you like, when you get somewhere, you're like, well, how does it, you don't even think about how does it happen. It's sort of like, I'm here, I'll wait for them to come get me. And then 2 weeks go by and like, this isn't working out.
I know. Well, that's the funny thing is like people ask me too. I get like Twitter messages from people who are like, hey, like I want to be an actor. Can I, how can I be on Stranger Things?
Yeah.
And I'm like, this was a lifetime of humiliation, rejection and work that landed me on a show that got past the first season.
Yeah.
And you think that you haven't even acted before.
Yeah.
But like, we're just going to invite you.
Is that what you tweeted back?
No, I don't. I say, I don't.
You
I just,
tweeted back
I
like, this is actually the way. Good luck. I hope someone sees this.
That's like taking the cowboy hat, right? Isn't it? It's like wearing it around for a day.
Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of like wearing it around for a day.
That's exactly it.
But yeah, so it all fell apart at like 24. And
that's good and young though, man.
Yeah, and that's actually when I got, you know, when I stopped drinking and stuff.
Yeah,
and
no,
I,
but like you got that in early and it stuck.
Yeah.
Weed?
Yeah. No, it stuck because basically what happened was it was funny. Like I got sober and it all fell apart and I had gotten an agent before then, like a really, you know, kind of crappy agent.
Right.
But I did get like a week into sobriety. I got my first paid, I was on a soap opera. I was a day player on As the World Turns. And it was like, suddenly like I could make money, I could pay my rent. And so it was very clear.
It was like, a regular gig?
Well, it started out just as a day, and then I guess they liked me or whatever, so they just kept putting me in. And it was like a recurring kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
For like 3 years.
And that was a gift of sobriety. You're like a week in. You're like, look at that.
Exactly. It's like that thing they talk about, cash and prizes or whatever, right? It's like you actually
got them early.
Clean up. And I did actually get them early. I was like really... Yeah.
But like, so when does the abrupt journey into Catholicism happen?
like year and a half into
sobriety?
Into sobriety, yeah.
Wow, that was what you chose.
Well, here's the thing. So I got sober in the East Village.
Yeah.
And I would go, and here's the thing about like being sober at 24 is like you feel like such hell. And then you get sober and all these like adorable East Village, like girls and guys, like everyone, and they're not drinking anymore, so like their skin looks great, like everybody looks healthy, and they're all like the cool kids that I always wanted to drink with, but like was weird and awkward.
They're all going out of their mind and fucking each other.
Kind of, yes. And but also like being so kind of loving.
Yeah.
So like even if they won't fuck you, they're still like, keep coming back. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
But I got sober with these people, but one of the guys in there was this really fascinating guy who was, he was like a gay guy from the East Village, artist, painter, but was like a strict, like huge Catholic. He used to go to Latin masses and like loved Catholicism. And he was trained, he was going to become a monk with the Franciscans in Pennsylvania.
No kidding.
And so eventually like he was my sponsor. I thought he was the most brilliant guy I'd ever met. Like super smart and super into principles. Like wanted to do as little as possible with the capitalist system. Lived in like an SRO for like $50 a month.
Yeah.
Bathroom down the hall, like mat on the floor. Would paint oil paintings. And just was totally, you know,
living
kind of counterculture.
Aesthetic life?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But like completely, I mean, capitalism makes whores of us all, right? Like didn't want to be involved as little as possible.
Right.
Would actually make
but
money
really
doing focus groups.
Yeah.
which was hilarious. Oh, you get paid to do focus groups
watch
for
bad movies,
ad agencies, or yeah, yeah. But he became my sponsor, and
yeah,
like he was a brilliant guy, and we would talk about, we basically like talk about, you know, philosophy, like
yeah,
all the time,
and, yeah,
and he introduced me to De Profundis, which is like Oscar Wilde's letter to Bozzi that uh-huh, he wrote when he was in Reading Jail.
Oh, really?
Which is like a 200-page, basically like letter of Oscar Wilde just saying to Bozzi, like, you're horrible, but also like going through his life and going through how nothing works.
Yeah.
And basically like, I've tried everything
right,
as an aesthete art, yeah, and like there's no salvation. And then he does say in the letter, he says, the only thing that may work is Christianity, but there's only one guy who's ever done it, St. Francis of Assisi. Like, and I was like fascinated that a
yeah,
guy like Oscar Wilde would think that that was like the answer.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I was very interested in the answer. Like,
yeah,
I didn't really understand what the point of this meat market of death, as
yeah,
I would describe it. Like, we're just born into this world. It's just blood, tooth, claw, things eating each other
yeah,
constantly,
right,
like shitting and
yeah,
eating.
Yeah.
And like what the great fuck is this? This is crazy.
Those
it's
are depressing. Great sober thoughts.
Well, I got to say, like, once... That's when I realized my problems was when I got sober. It wasn't
yeah,
when
sure,
I was drinking.
No, yeah,
like when I was drinking,
yeah,
I was like fine. I was numbed
yeah,
out.
Yeah.
But then I got sober, my brain started like, you know. And then he went off to become a monk, and he sort of got me into Catholicism.
Yeah.
I started reading the catechism, and I started like doing catechism's instruction
yeah,
with this Catholic priest. And I started getting into mystic saints, which
sure,
are like Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross,
yeah,
and, like Augustine and Aquinas and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Like and it was like
it's all in there. It's weird. You go to Europe, you go to Italy and these places, and I was sort of amazed at, you know, you go to these different cathedrals and little towns, these huge cathedrals that were just sort of overwhelming. You know, they just were designed to make the peasants just humble themselves. And just the sheer amount of dead wizards that, you know, they have in these places. Like, you realize, like, this has really been going on a long time. Every one of these joints has at least 9 dead popes in it. And,
yeah,
you know, like, there's so, and you just feel like, it's just like, there's something, you know, I always say witchy about it, but there is a real mind fuck to the mystical history of the Catholics. There's
yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah. And I find it beautiful and fascinating. I mean, like, I remember reading Teresa of Avila and like sexy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like reading Teresa of Avila, like this Interior Castles book, and just all it all being about this ecstatic connection
yeah,
to
sure,
God that just made you feel so much.
Yeah, and who doesn't want to have mania when you're a depressive, boundaryless, sad person?
So, here's the interesting thing, which I've never truly spoken about publicly.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to, like, because we wanted to talk about the speech and
yeah,
stuff too
oh,
later
right,
on. But I actually was in this Catholicism thing, and he had left, and I was sober for like a year and a half,
yeah,
and I was 25, and I actually did have a manic episode where, and I was diagnosed as bipolar.
Really?
Yeah. So I am.
What'd you get done during the manic episode?
I really had like a bit of a break.
Oh yeah.
Where I you know, I thought I was in connection to some sort of God
yeah,
that I wasn't really in connection to.
And you were getting the signals?
Yeah, yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Talking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, and writing a lot.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing. And it was like, you know, yeah, I had all the answers suddenly.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I...
No drugs?
No. But the interesting thing about it is like, I realized that I don't really need them.
Like, right.
That I have a capacity to see the elves
yeah,
in the corners of the room if I really allow myself to go there. Yeah. So I actually was... by my parents, sort of taken into a mental asylum for
oh,
a
yeah,
little bit.
And, so you're living like your heroes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I have to say one thing about the mental asylum. Is I've romanticized two things in my life.
Yeah.
And both have fallen short.
Oh, yeah.
One is being in a mental asylum. Really, really not as fun as you think it is. No, but you do. You have a romantic idea of like you're a genius.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then it just winds up being, you know, sad
smells
hospital, like shit.
Yeah.
And smells like, you know,
people walking slowly.
And the other thing was boating. Like,
yeah,
I just recently went on a ship in open water.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd read Moby Dick like
yeah,
a million times. And I was like, this is good. And it's really not as...
No, it's terrifying.
It's not sexy.
Horrible.
It's horrible. It's horrible. It's
almost...
very similar to the mental asylum experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I was diagnosed bipolar, and then that's when actually the drugs came in. I've been medicated for bipolar for a long time.
Oh, that's great.
And I've been And I've had problems sort of going on and off. I've had a struggle.
Sure.
Going on and off the medication.
Because you missed a mania.
Yeah. Or you think that you're not the artist that you could be.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You think you're not digging as deeply as you could be.
So you're the plug off.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Let's open this baby up. Like, you know, take the governor off. Yeah. But it's funny. Also, the funny thing about my particular brain,
yeah,
or like mental illness, is that every time that I've had an episode like that, it's always coupled with spirituality. So the weird thing about me is people are like, I need to meditate more.
Yeah.
I need to like get into yoga, right, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I need to like eat a cheeseburger and just like smoke cigarettes and hang out.
Yeah.
Because like the minute I get close to that, what I consider a flame,
yeah,
of like the answers and the mysticism and the like, I'm completely present and I'm in, like, it's like I'm out of my mind. So it's like if I write the self-help book,
yeah,
it's gonna be about like, you know what, sit on the couch, yeah, like play some video games,
yeah,
like,
yeah, don't let your brain run away with you, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Like quit,
yeah, because like around. if you let your brain run away, you're just you're like you know, maybe a few days shy of walking down the street with a robe.
No joke. Yeah. Like,
telling people, like, I know.
Exactly. Like, come join me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In my walk.
It's an amazing thing.
And tell me, does the rationalization start with, like, maybe I'm not crazy? Maybe
are you kidding? First of all, have you ever been to a mental asylum?
No.
The only thing that defines a crazy person and a normal person, yeah, the only thing, because
yeah,
they can seem, you can seem very normal as,
yeah,
a crazy person.
Yeah.
The only thing divides is they're convinced they're sane. Like, crazy people are convinced, yeah, they're, yeah, sane.
You don't understand.
No, they don't. Yeah. I'm the only one who gets it. It's incredible. It's a funny conversation that's happening in this country right now with, you know, the shooters and,
yeah,
everything in terms of gun control, and people want to make it about mental illness.
Right.
But the thing is, my experiences with mentally ill people and all this stuff is that in general, I've met tons of like gentle, like wonderful people.
Yeah.
Like, I think, sure, that there really is still a stigma that's like this strange thing about,
oh yeah,
like,
that's always psychotics and, you know, yeah, and people, yeah, so like once you got leveled off, your acting, you know, started to pick up, or like when did you start doing Broadway and stuff?
Well, yeah,
yeah,
like once I kind of got, yeah, that problem under control,
yeah,
and then I, you know, I was doing like kind of smaller plays, and then I wound up doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on Broadway.
You got a Tony or something, right?
Nomination, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Lost.
Yeah. It's great.
That's good, yeah. No, it was great. It was a great show. It was a really great show. And Kathleen Turner.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you were the younger couple?
Or yeah.
You, okay.
We were Nick and Honey. Me and this actress, Mira Enos. Do you know her?
No.
You ever watch The Killing?
I didn't see it.
She's great actress.
Yeah.
Really great actress. And Bill Irwin. Do you know Bill Irwin?
I do know. Yeah.
He's a clown.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was Mr. Noodle on Sesame Street.
Did he play that? He played the older guy?
He played George, yeah.
Really?
And he was great because, like, the thing about the movie is, like, the movie of Richard Burton in that role.
Yeah.
And he's, like, such a
powerhouse.
I know
that guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Bill is, like, a skinny, weird kind of dude. And
right.
And, like, you have Kathleen Turner, who's, like, you know, Kathleen Turner.
Right.
So it was a kind of a great combination. Very different production.
That's great.
But it was like a rock concert, man. People really loved it.
Oh, yeah?
It was like, oh, yeah. Like every night we'd come out and people would like scream and cheer.
Really?
It's a very funny play.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a humiliating play. I did it for a year.
Yeah.
And like, Nick in particular, gets so humiliated at the end of the play. Like he can't get it up with her.
Right.
And And I remember being made fun of, and I remember like around 8 months in, just like, and the audience would howl with laughter when she would like make these jokes about him like not being able.
Yeah.
And I just remember like about 8 months in having these like little dizzy spells where I'd just be so mad at the audience for laughing at me, because I'd so deeply, like I realized I spent more time in that house. Like I would spend 3 hours a day, 8 shows a week. So I spent like so much time actually in that house experiencing that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was almost like,
oh yeah, you crossed
over.
It's
almost over. Like you're, you're actually living that life more than you are your own.
So the upside down was a prophecy.
Exactly.
The upside down was actually theater for you.
Exactly. There was funny stuff that happened too though. Like we would, like about like 8 or 9 months in too, this was crazy. Like you do a play, it's the same play, you know, for 8 shows a week. And I remember about 8 or 9 months in being ready to make my entrance at the door.
Yeah.
And like having this like heart-stopping fear and going like, somebody get me a script. I don't know any of my lines. Someone get me a script. I don't know any of my, and they would open the door and it would just come out of your mouth. And you just, but like for some reason, this fear would just wash over me that I didn't know. You'd been doing it for so long.
Somebody get me a script.
But
then, it's
but also like, also you'd be on, because it gets surreal, like you're doing the same thing, and then you'd be on the couch like talking to someone and you'd say a line.
Yeah.
And then you go like, did I just say or was that the matinee?
Yeah.
Or was that like 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's completely surreal experience.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Talking about like, you know, between the manias and like doing a play for a year. Yeah,
no relaxing. Like,
yeah, it's just complete.
But it's crazy. So funny, even when things are going well, you're just, your brain just sort of like, nope, no, no.
It's not going to be okay. Yeah, never, it's not going to, you've done this for 8 months. It's no, not going to be okay. Get me a script. Get me a script. Your just boy. Let me look at the, just look.
Give me a script. Yeah, God, that's great. So was that, and that was your big theater break?
Yeah, yeah, that was a big break. Yeah, so we did that for like 8 months on Broadway, and then like 5 months in London.
Yeah,
we
oh wow,
there. Yeah, that was kind of cool.
And the medicine's working, and everything's good.
Medicine's working, all good. Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple episodes since then.
Yeah,
but it's been when I've tampered with this idea, you know,
that you're because okay.
Yeah, exactly. And that and the shame sort of that I've dealt with throughout the years about it.
Oh, about being, I mean, on it?
Yeah, and just being, yeah.
And that weird, when the sickness talks to you, it's like, you're not, you're being your full self.
Yeah,
yeah,
or like, man. you're not being your full self. And also like, you know, but there's even more insidious ones, which is like, and it's not that I completely disagree with this, but pharmaceutical companies are conspiring against this. And like, they're trying to get you addicted to lifelong medications and you're better, you know.
Yeah. You know, yeah,
or like, but also, like, I gotta say, even in representations in movies, they're very irresponsible. Like, I remember being really pissed off at that movie, A Beautiful Mind, because like he basically at the end of the movie decides that he doesn't need medication and he can just control the voices and he can just kind of put them off to the
decorate
side,
decorate his house
and
with, like with things on the wall.
but it's like, you know, there are also these images in movies of like people going off their medications and finally being like liberated. And I think that like the best representation I've ever seen of it is like Homeland. Like, I think that's really sophisticated interpretation of it, where you can be sort of brilliant and highly functional and all this stuff, and then also you can have these things where if you're not being responsible in that way,
that's the thing. Is like, pharmaceuticals are a big business, but there have been advances in Western medicine that have made life better for people who have problems and are sick.
Correct. But my East Village conspiracy theory, shadow government idea, talks to me in those weak moments and says like, they're just trying to control you. They're putting, you know.
Yeah, well, it's like somebody once said about, like, there's a story, AA story, where some guy says that he had a sponsor where he said, like, at the beginning of sobriety, he's like, hey, man, they're brainwashing me.
Yeah.
And the sponsor goes, like, well, maybe your brain needed washing.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. It's like, so what, dude?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you feel better. Everyone likes you more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I get the struggle with that, you know, because, you know, I've been... Like, even with, like, fucking statins, you know, like, you know, I had to go in, like, I have high cholesterol.
Okay.
And then there's this whole camp of people who are like, no, you don't need the statin, just do diet. So, like, I do diet, and I can't get it down because there's a genetic component to it. And then they're like, well, how, they're not really sure how important cholesterol is. I'm like, I went to a cardiologist who said that if you take these, no more plaque might come. You might not, you know, it might not ever get worse, the plaque.
Right.
A cardiologist said that to me. So you want me not to believe
Where's
him?
Where's your degree?
And you've been looking around the internet?
Everybody's got an opinion. Yeah, everybody's got an opinion in the tribe.
But like, no one wants to be on medicine. You know,
of course.
Right. So that, I mean, you know, I'm good. I can fix it.
Yeah.
But at some point you have to realize, like, you know, sometimes medicine's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's no polio.
Yeah. You know, no, but there's this weird thing with like holistic
Yeah, I mean, come you know, on. Like, you know, what are you going to drink? How much St. John's wort can you take?
No, exactly.
You know, this tea will do it. Yeah, it won't. Yeah. Not even do it.
I know. And the funny thing is, like, all that stuff connected to me. Because I, for a while, like, this is a funny thing, was I, after, like, when I got these conspiracy theories, I was like, look, I'm going to be super responsible.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do yoga every, like, I feel like there's a component of this. There's a component of this that is psychophysical.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, if I can have a steady blah, blah, blah. And I did that. And, of course, like, you know, I had another, like, episode. I was like, because it's linked to this idea. Like, I mean, part of the idea of madness in general is that consciousness, it's all our collective idea of sanity, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Like, so if I was on a mountaintop with a bunch of, like, you know, other crazy, we were behaving in this way, it might be okay.
Yeah.
But in terms of sanctioned American society,
sure,
like, there are things in our society that are crazy,
yeah,
but, like, we all agree on them.
Yeah.
Like, that we don't, we eat.
No, I get it.
We eat cows, but we don't eat dogs.
Yeah,
like,
but you, no.
It's crazy, it, but like,
you can hold
it's cool.
Right. But yeah, I mean, if you wanted to hold the space of the guy that, you know, can't function in a workspace and is occasionally hospitalized, you can do that.
Exactly. Exactly. And I was like, I'd rather, like, have an acting career. be able to, like, sit down and do a podcast. This podcast would be funny if I wasn't. I should come back for that.
Let me know. I'll get your new number.
We'll talk about elves on the side of
when you decide it's a good week not to be on medicine.
We'll talk about the shadow government then. Yeah, we'll get into it. I'll bring you some cocaine as well. We'll both get into it.
That's going to be a big day. We'll just end our careers right live on the air.
That would be amazing.
It would be crazy.
God, be my favorite day ever.
Yeah. No, and then we just disappear.
Yeah.
You'll be like, did you hear that thing that
they're
David and Mark did? I don't know where they are.
They just beat each other to death in that studio, apparently.
Did you have another episode as bad as the original one?
Not as bad. No,
right.
Not as bad.
So Stranger Things, I have to assume that you did not anticipate to be a rock star at Comic-Con.
No. Like, as a 40-year-old man.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
no, I don't.
When
I've
I was
never
22,
been.
Like, yeah. I maybe had fantasies. But, yeah, when you hit 40, you're kind of like, I mean, so when I hit, like, I think when I hit 35, I was kind of like, that idea is over.
But, like, to be part of something is sort of interesting, and you had no idea, right? You took, you know, but you liked the role. When you,
well, yeah, I mean, I read the script. The pilot script was like, I love that pilot script. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't think I'd get cast, and then I wound up getting cast.
Yeah.
It's a big Netflix show.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
And I didn't think they wanted to take a chance on me. Like,
but did they really know that it was going to be big before, you know, I mean, how does anyone know anything?
I don't think they knew, but still, the thing at the time,
it wasn't based on a comic or anything, right?
No,
it's
no,
an original.
No, original. Yeah. But I didn't know that Netflix was doing that many series. Like, now it seems like they're doing everything. But at the time, it felt like kind of like a big deal.
Oh, right.
But when we were shooting it, about four episodes in, I thought, yeah, no one's going to watch this. I thought, you know, this is not, I'm not good, and it's not good. And it didn't help we were all just like, you know, we were working really hard, but we were in a bubble. And, like, nobody cared.
Where'd you shoot it?
Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. I like the kids. Like, it's queer. The balance between the kids and then, you know, like, all the other shit.
Yeah.
You know, they chose the kids, you know, because you got to have that, you know, right?
Yeah.
But they got some good kids.
Yeah.
Okay, so four episodes in, you're shooting it, and you're like, oh, my God. Now I got to
I just thought it was like,
look at the
weeds, in a long
wall.
Line of failures. It was like sort of a, not tremendous. I mean, I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but there were, like, I don't know if you've had these projects, but, like, you have a project where everybody's, like, patting themselves on the back.
Yeah.
And also they come up to you, and they're like, your life's going to change.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And you're like.
Yeah.
I've had that happen to me.
I'm ready.
For about, like, 10 years. Years, you know, I shot this movie Revolutionary Road, and I remember, like, all of us.
I like that movie.
It's good. But I remember that being like us, everyone sitting around and being like, oh,
is that after Brokeback?
And it was after Brokeback. Yeah.
Well, you had a smaller part.
Yeah,
Brokeback.
Smaller part. Yeah. Brokeback. But it was a bit of a bigger. But it just didn't. It just had no. Like, I was still, like, living in my little studio apartment, like, auditioning for shit.
Right,
and people
right.
being like, yeah, we don't really like him, you know? Yeah. And I was like, wow, like, it'll never change.
Gonna
and
like then, a,
I'm going to be kind of that guy who, like, can occasionally, like, get by and, like, make money and, like, do theater. Like, I do feel like I had a home in theater.
Yeah.
But we, But then I got to, so when I was shooting that, like my expectations are extremely low.
But what about with Black Mass and like, yeah,
Even that, it's like
the supporting role.
Yeah, but, like you're in Denzel's movie. Like nobody really cares. Or you're in Johnny Depp's movie.
Right.
What I mean? Like nobody really cares. People within the industry,
yeah,
people are like, hey, did a great job. Or occasionally some guy came up to the street. But it wasn't.
Like, great character actor. You can be a great character actor.
But even less than that, because it wasn't like, I don't live in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So I live in New York.
Right.
So it was kind of like you dip in and out, okay.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like casting directors were like throwing me offers and people were like wanting me in their movies.
Right.
It was kind of like, when we haven't cast a part,
right,
we'll call him in.
We'll
see if he does a good job and maybe.
So you were ready for the Stranger Things.
Well, I didn't think it would ever happen, but I was fine with that. Like, I was living in New York and I was doing plays. But also I was doing, and my thrust had always been plays. And so there was even a moment when, like, I had auditioned for Black Mass.
Yeah.
And I got offered another play in New York. There was a big deal sort of thing. And
yeah,
I thought to myself, I was like, you know, New York will, I think that New York theater, there's more of a community. Whereas like Hollywood, you're just a commodity, right?
Sure.
Like if you do well, if people like, if
a
your movies make
and
money.
A heightened community.
Yeah, but if your movies make money, we'll hire you. Blah,
sure.
Blah, blah. But if they don't, like who cares? Whereas like in New York theater, there's more of a sense of like, we want to see you develop as an artist. We want to see what you can do. We want to support you, even if you're, everything you do is not great. So I remember like even in Black Mass having this moment where I was like, nah, I don't, you know, Hollywood's not going to care about me. So I'm and kind of thinking about giving that up.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I kind
took
of,
it.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
it was some drama around that. But I ultimately did it. But I've always had this relationship with Hollywood. It's been like, I can go there and make some money.
Yeah.
But like, I'll never really put my heart in it. And I'd grown really cynical. Like even doing those movies, which I felt like I was doing like good, okay work, but it wasn't. Like when I'd go to work, I was just very cynical. And I was just very like, yeah, what do you want me to do? Like carry a gun, like run around, like, okay. You know what I mean? I had grown, for better, for
cynical,
worse.
I
had grown
somewhat cynical. Yeah. Sure, because
and I was like,
had a lot of shots.
Yeah, had some shots. Yeah. And I was like, I just don't have it. And also like the film business is weird for me because I don't think I'm like that bad of an actor, but I do look at my face sometimes on film and I'm like, oh God. Like, I mean, like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
what do you see?
Ugly. I mean, you just see like double chins and you see like, you know, weird width of the face.
Oh, sure. The old weird width of the face problem.
Don't you have idiosyncratic things yourself that you see in pictures and you're just like.
There are times, dude, where I go to the bathroom and I can't look in the mirror.
I do the exact same thing.
I go pee. I avoid myself.
I do the exact same thing and I was working with, and there was somebody. Somebody who's helping me design my apartment, and they were like, we could put a big mirror here. And I was like, I don't want mirrors. I don't want any mirrors. They're like, well, in the bathroom. I was like, debatable. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. Not today, though.
I'm hiding from myself. As I walk by to the shower.
You know, there's that play, No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre. Yeah, and the one of the things, they're in hell. And the one of the things is there's no mirrors.
Yeah.
And I was like, how's that hell? Like,
it's great. No body image issues. Hell sounds like heaven.
Exactly. That's great. But anyway, so I'd grown very cynical. So this was another one of these opportunities where like my expectations were extremely low.
Yeah.
And then we're in there shooting it.
Yeah.
And I do think like I look like hell. And I think like, and I'm scared. And so before it came out, I was scared. And then I was actually doing a play with a guy who was on a very successful TV show.
Right.
And before it came out, like three weeks before it came out, there was no ads in New York. No ads on buses.
They'd lost hope already?
And then a week before it came out, no ads anywhere. No ads anywhere. Huh. Okay.
Why?
Well, I talked to him and I was like, yeah, there's no ads. Is that, you know, he was like, they're burying it. They're trying to bury it. And I was like, oh my God, my one fucking shot. And like, they're burying my show. And then it came out and it was like a zeitgeist.
Well, can you never know what Netflix is going to get behind? Yeah.
But also, like, I don't know what they did for Glow or what, but they claim now, in hindsight,
that they did it on purpose.
Exactly. Which it was a brilliant marketing campaign where they.
We didn't advertise.
Where people have ownership of this show because they discover it and they tell their friends. And it is kind of brilliant when you think about it, if that is the case, because that is what happened.
Right.
But I think it might just be looking at what happened. Well,
that would be a fine sort of like thing to believe if they didn't actually bury other shows. Like if they did actually leave many shows hanging that they actually produced, that would be a great genius
exactly
thing.
If there wasn't tons of evidence to the contrary. Yeah, like a detective. What's going on here?
No, but either way, they do produce so much shit, so some shit is going to have to find its audience. And this is the kind of thing, you know, it is in the realm of things that have this an activate. If the thing activates that audience, if it appeals to that community, then, you know, it lives there forever. There are people that are, you know, I'm sure creating, you know, backstories to things. They have, you know, mystery, they have questions.
Fan fiction.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Right. Yeah. And there's also the Comic-Con, like for some reason, the genre shows are those shows that like stick around and have huge followings and stuff like that.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's sort of like in fantasy in and of itself, though, it's never been my thing, though it seems to be becoming my thing a little more. And then ultimately, what isn't fantasy? But you know, they, you know, people get very loyal to them, and if the show stays good, you know, they're there for it.
Yeah.
So you're surprised by it. So you here we're still at you freaking out that they're burying it. And then what happens?
Yeah, I'm backstage and he's like, you know, and then
he can I get a script?
The guy, he's the worst. Yeah. No, he was the worst too. He's like, like reviews came out too, and he was like, it'll probably be like a, you know, respected show in some way, but people aren't gonna watch it. There are tons of those shows on Netflix too, on like Hulu and all the shows where everybody's like, oh, it's so good. Yeah, I don't watch it.
How can you watch everything?
Well, that's the thing. There's just too many. And look, I think, and again, you might not be the target audience for this conversation, but I so believe the show is brilliant.
Yeah.
Not only on a sci-fi level, but it has so much heart and like soul.
Exactly.
And it's
that's why I can't stop watching it.
Yeah. It really is watchable.
It bridges,
in a way that like, and the other funny thing was like we had some reviews come out for second season that were like kind of negative.
Yeah.
But they were like, the reviews are so funny because they're like, yeah, it wasn't so good. I watched the shit out of it from beginning to end immediately. But and I'm like, what show do you do that? Yeah. That's hard to do.
And also there that the strange human component that not only the kids bring to a certain degree, but that you and Ryder bring, you know, having had lives and having had, you know, like she brings something, you know, just by virtue of who she is, but she's acting the fuck out of this.
Yeah.
And you know, you guys have, you know, both have had your problems that are very upfront in the first season and devastating. So, you know, between you, your very grown up sort of dispositions and character shortcomings as the characters, you know, I'm not, you know, you're doing a good job with it, but you're flawed people.
Yeah. No, exactly.
And the weird sort of, you know, excitement of these overly bright kids that, you know, you transcend, you know, when you fall into the hole, you know, like
it transcends genre in that way.
Well, no, it's just sort of still a human, that human element is so strong that you're not going to be like, you know, what are all those snakes exactly? And why can he just step on them? And, you know, so like,
right. The little,
you know, like, what?
That's a great question, though. Now that I think about it, oh Jesus! A new script.
But the last time I saw those snakes, there was something laying eggs in the kid, and he said, "What are they doing to him?" You're like, so, like, but because you're hooked into Hop, and you're like, "Is he going to get out of there?"
Yeah, exactly.
You're not like, "Where's the egg laying snake?
Right.
How many more of these fucking? Why is?
Right.
Where's the
you're
rest?
You're just
of,
willing to go with it because
you
just get on the ride. And
you have to be.
But that you're right. That's an example of character because you care about the characters. You're paying much more attention to their reaction to something than to the actual. Something.
Sure. Like I'm like in, you know, I'm right at the like the last thing I watched last night was Will in a seizure because he's now feeling the evil of the thing.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And I'm like, you know, now like, you know, are we ever going to save this kid? You know, is Will just going to?
We put this kid through
this punching
so much.
Bag
we put this kid through so much. You know what? There actually was. This is so funny because I speak of punching bag. So they. they had at one point, you know, because I talk to them a little bit as they develop. Yeah. Like I go in the room sometimes and I'll talk to them about ideas and stuff. And at one point I had said to them, because in season one, I punch a lot of people in the face.
Yeah.
And it was like one of my favorite things about that character is that he has a Harrison Ford type quality where when he gets confused, he just like punches somebody. And in season two, I had no punches in the, like I don't punch anybody the whole season. And they were like, we're going to give you a really good punch. And I was like, what is the... They were like, no, it's going to be great. It's going to be great. I was like, what is it? What is it? And they were like, Will, when he goes into a seizure on the football field, like nobody can get him out of the seizure. And you punch him in the face. And he comes out of the seizure. And then finally they were like, that's a terrible idea. And I was like, yeah, it's a terrible idea. I loved it. But it was so crazy. It was like, yeah, you can't have him punch somebody. Like, the kid is a literal punching bag at that point. Like, what else can we do to Will Byers? Like,
he's being beat up.
Let's get Hopper to punch him in the face because that's what he needs.
Yeah, he's been beat up in two dimensions.
It's true. That poor kid. That poor kid. That poor guy.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
But, like, I'm going to finish it up. And so you're in season two now. And when does Hellboy start?
We shot it.
You did?
Yeah, yeah. We shot it in this fall.
How long did that take?
Like 4 months.
Really?
Yeah, in Sofia, Bulgaria.
So you had it in Bulgaria?
Yeah.
So you had it, you were in the makeup?
Yeah.
But see, that, it's all happening. It's all happening now. How cynical are you now?
Oh, I know.
About the movie business.
I'm so grumpy. Can I still be grumpy?
Did you call Perlman up?
We did. We had dinner.
Oh, yeah?
We had dinner, yeah.
So Perlman, like, you passed the reins on to you?
A little bit. I mean, it was not a great situation.
How many had he done? Here's the thing.
Like, they did two, him and Guillermo del Toro, right?
Yeah, right.
And they I think, wanted to make their third trilogy, but I think a lot of issues came up. I think budgets were too big. I think that they took a lot of time. They waited too long and stuff. Right. And so I think that they, you know, they wanted to do something else. They wanted to do something different with it.
Yeah.
And then they came to me, and it was a very different concept, very different idea. And there was initially some bluster around it. And then I think everybody was like, kind of got it. And Ron got it.
Yeah.
And came. And so, yeah, we had dinner, and he was like, he was just really cool, you know?
Yeah.
I think that the one thing that's a little weird is, like, you know, everybody now asks him about it, and I think he's annoyed at that.
Sure.
And so he said some things on Twitter and stuff where he's like, just don't ask me anymore. And I think that's fucking don't ask him anymore.
Yeah.
But he did sort of, you know, he likes me. He was very kind to me, and he was like, good luck, kid. Like, do it. You know, he's a nice guy.
And he knows the business.
Yeah, exactly.
And you like that? You think it's going to be a good movie?
I do, yeah.
And were you able to bring some of that, your flaws and heart to Hellboy?
Of course.
Okay.
Underneath, like, pounds and pounds of prosthetics.
There's just a self-hating guy that doesn't like mirrors.
Yeah, I mean, it's right up my alley. Like, who are you going to call? guy hasn't looked at a mirror in a long time.
Yeah. And where are you done? You're shooting Stranger Things now?
No, we start in like a month.
The third season?
Yeah, season three.
Now, how many scripts do you see up front?
We usually see 4 to 6.
Oh, really?
Yeah, of the 8.
So that's good for you because you like to know how at least something's going to end.
I want to know the whole arc, yeah. And so I actually...
Will they tell you or are they done writing?
I do know
the
general arc,
yeah.
But but to me it's even important, like, in terms of how that stuff plays out. Because I do like to structure stuff up front. Like, if I know that the guy's going to talk a lot in the end. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of things about an actual script that are different than a pitch.
Right.
But I do know what's kind of going to happen. I'm excited about it. It's really good.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, the ideas are amazing. And
what's poor Will going to be dragged to the center of the earth this season?
We're going to try to completely rip him apart. You know what the character that I have the most sympathy for, though? The one that gets beat up the most? The Byers wall phone. Wall-mounted phone.
Oh, yeah.
Gets every season at some point. You'll see, you haven't gotten there yet. Just gets, like, people just ripping it off, throwing it and stuff. Yeah. Makes Will Byers look like, you know, nothing.
Yeah. Oh, the poor phone. The poor phone. Well, look, man, I think we covered it. I think we did good.
Yeah, that was great.
I feel a little buzzed.
Yeah, right? Good. No, I had a good time.
Okay, man.
I had a good time.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
That was exciting. No? Yeah? Sure it was. Absolutely it was. Oh, did I mention, I should mention that my friend Lynn Shelton's movie Outside In is now available on Netflix. You should watch that with the Duplass, the Jay Duplass and Edie Falco. Great movie. You should watch that on that on the Netflix. And also, I guess I'll play guitar. I've gotten two compliments about how the guitar sounds in here. Not my playing necessarily, but the sound quality. Boomer lives.